From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the founding CEO of the Malala Fund talks about constructive anger and how to channel energy into activism.
So anger in itself is not a bad thing. It's moving to a place where we are doing the right thing, doing the most effective thing, listening, but then not backing down from our principles and our values.
Later, a new book sheds light on a genre of movies that film historians have largely ignored.
Plus, the Milwaukee Art Museum's current exhibition gives us a primer on the concept of modernism.
We're looking at artists who were thinking about experimentation, who were taking the sort of standards and traditions of art and rethinking them.
And Radio Chipstone goes looking for authentic 1960s and 70s living rooms. Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The story of Malala Yousafzai is known around the world. She was the young girl in Pakistan who was shot in the head by militants who sought to keep her and other girls from getting an education. She survived the shooting and became an advocate for girls' education around the world, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her work.
Shiza Shahid had met Malala 2 years before she was shot. Shahid was attending Stanford University, but had returned to her native Pakistan to run a summer camp for girls from rural parts of the country. After Malala was shot, Shahid changed her post-graduation plans and co-founded the Malala Fund to support global education efforts.
Today, Shiza Shahid is the leader of a company called Now Ventures, which helps fund startups around the world working for social change. She was in Milwaukee earlier this year to speak at Mount Mary University, and that's where I caught up with her. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, so we're having this conversation right after you spoke in front of a room of, 500 or 1,000 mainly women at Mount Mary College, and you shared your story and you shared Malala's story, and these are both really compelling, really important stories to tell. And yet, as I looked around, the moment that seemed to be recorded the most on paper and on smartphones was when you talked about the concept of ikigai. And I guess the question I have for you is, can you explain that and why it's so important to you?
Absolutely. Ikigai is a Japanese word, which means purpose for being. And the reason that it was important for me to share it was to really bring it back to the students and the educators and the professionals in the audience. What can they do? Inspiration is important, but action really matters. I think sometimes it can be complicated to know where to start. And I think sometimes we believe that the various elements of ikigai or purpose for being are incompatible with one another. So I want to change the world, but will I really be able to build a strong career and support my family? I'm uniquely talented as an artist, but is that really impactful for the world? We're not taught that we can bring these together and be entrepreneurial and innovative and chart our own path. So what I was trying to highlight with this concept was you get to decide how you live and how you create, and you can be entrepreneurial and creative and bring together your unique talent with what you believe the world needs, with the passions that you have around certain social issues, and combine them to really create a career and a legacy that is fulfilling and impactful.
Was your work, was your contact with Malala, was that the light bulb moment for you when it came to ikigai?
I think the light bulb moment was more recent. I think that when I was younger, with the work that I did in Pakistan and the work that I did with Malala, I was deeply impassioned and things would happen and I would get angry or inspired and I would just act. I would just show up. And I think that was another important lesson for me to impart on young people here is when you're inspired or angry or moved, just show up. Don't think it's not my place or who am I? Because too often we don't feel empowered to actually make a difference. It's not that we don't care, it's that we think it's not our place. When I was younger, I think I was just showing up. And one thing led to another, and I was able to make a difference, and I recognized that. I think now at 27, with these experiences behind me, I really had a moment to stop and pause and choose what I did next. And I thought, what can I do in this moment to have the greatest impact? What is it that I can uniquely do? What do I want to be doing every day? What does the day-to-day of this job or this choice look like? And can it really scale? And so I think my ikigai is now, but I don't know. You can ask me a few years later and I might give you the same answer.
Well, and so you grew up in Pakistan and you talk about anger. And I guess the question I have is, what do you make of the anger that exists in this country today? We hear a lot about how angry people are on all sides of the political spectrum.
I think that there is destructive anger and there's constructive anger. Destructive anger is when we are unwilling to listen, when we are so inflamed that we are not able to act in a way that is useful. Constructive anger is when we see injustice and we are moved to act. When we are able to pause long enough to really understand the issue and make sure that we're doing the right thing and the most effective thing, but then we don't back down because we know that if we do, those who are vulnerable will be hurt, will be attacked, will be put in a position that is wrong. And that to me is constructive anger. So anger in itself is not a bad thing. It's moving to a place where we are doing the right thing, doing the most effective thing, listening, but then not backing down from our principles and our values.
I know there are a lot of people waiting to talk to you. I have one more question, and that is how do you get past the one step forward, two steps back phenomenon? I mean, when something goes right and then bad things play their role in the world.
Yeah, you know, bad things aren't actors. People are actors. It's all people, right? Everything, natural disasters arguably are out of the control of man. But other than that, most things, wars, political upheaval, murders, crimes, poverty, these are all things that are man-made. So bad things aren't happening. We just have more people that are apathetic. We don't have more people doing bad things. We have some people doing bad things, but most people being apathetic. I also don't believe that we are fundamentally moving backwards. I think the trajectory of human evolution is positive. There are certain things that are deeply dangerous, like climate change, that could end human civilization. However, we have fewer people living in poverty than ever before, fewer women dying in childbirth. We have diseases like polio and malaria that are close to being eradicated. And so I think the trajectory is positive, but bad things happen when people are apathetic. And if we don't show up, that's when we may go two steps backward. And I think giving people the tools and the empowerment to feel like they have a voice, they have a choice, they have a responsibility is how you prevent that.
Do you wake up optimistic every morning?
I do. I do wake up optimistic, and if I don't, I play a upbeat song and get myself there.
All right, so I have to ask before I let you go, what song would you play?
Oh, wow. Happy by, is it Pharrell Williams? Yeah.
Well, Shahid, thank you so much, and best of luck in your work.
Thank you so much.
Shiza Shahid was the founding CEO of the Malala Fund and now directs a seed stage venture capital fund called Now Ventures. She was in Milwaukee this spring to speak at Mount Mary University's Women's Leadership Institute, and we spoke with her then.
A film scholar works to bring attention to an overlooked genre of cinema. We'll hear about her work and that work when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It was in the 1950s when courts decided that nudity was no longer equal to obscenity in movies. From those decisions, a genre of film known as sexploitation emerged and became a cottage industry while other parts of the film world were declining. Many of those films flew under the radar by presenting their subjects in a narrative context. Films we might term softcore today span many different genres, most commonly the sex melodrama.
Until very recently, the sexploitation films of the 1960s were largely overlooked or dismissed by film scholars. Elena Gorfinkel is working to change the perception of this decade in film. Gorfinkel is a former UW-Milwaukee professor who now teaches film studies at King's College London.
Her new book is called Lewd Looks, American Sex Exploitation Cinema in the 1960s, and it takes a deep dive into the salacious independent films made on the margins of Hollywood.
Gorfinkel talks about the book in Milwaukee this evening, but first she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and explained the film's unique characteristics and larger impact on American culture.
The films are incredibly preoccupied with female sexual autonomy in this period, and they progressed from fairly chaste exposure to kind of more explicit and more simulated sex scenarios by the late 60s. And the films themselves are also quite porous in that they would be a cycle of films about swingers, about the counterculture, about LSD, so that in many ways they would just absorb aspects of the culture and kind of pastiche it into stories that would work. The films were made on average $10,000 to $40,000, very low budget, and would be usually made on over a week's time with relatively unknown actors, and so that they had their appeal was quite different from the Hollywood film in a variety of ways. But they're really quite interesting documents about particular era's fantasies and anxieties about gender and sexuality and the autonomy of women in particular in a new order, in a new kind of economy and environment.
Exactly. And these films were made in the margin of Hollywood, which was an industry that had to change post-war. You know, it was no longer the big primary viewership of the silver screen. Mm-hmm. What new factors in entertainment and society during the 1960s was the classic Hollywood silver screen competing against that allowed these films to kind of surface in the margins?
Mm-hmm. Well, Hollywood production was declining, and it actually goes back all the way to, say, the mid-40s and the late 40s. There was a particular case against Hollywood, an antitrust case. It was called the Paramount decision, and that radically changed the industry in conjunction with the impact of television. And so the Paramount decision forced the studios to divest their holdings in exhibition, meaning they couldn't have a monopoly all the way down, what was called vertical integration. And so they had to sell off their theater holdings. And that meant that theaters would sit kind of empty as kind of Hollywood production declined, because they were also kind of trying to remain competitive, but people were doing different things with their free time in the 50s and in that kind of era of suburbanization in the U.S., drawing audiences in terms of forms of entertainment. So I think Hollywood felt it had to compete in a variety of ways. Hollywood, you know, also was seeing like the golden era of the studio period with kind of less capital, with less productions, was kind of becoming more tarnished. And the kind of big stars that one associated with Hollywood. Also, there was just a very different ethos emerging about stardom, too, that I think really contrasts in a really productive way with what sexploitation films offered. Because sexploitation films, like a filmic version of Playboy magazine or other kind of men's magazines, really offered this sense of this unvarnished girl next door, whereas I think Hollywood films, you know, there's still kind of holding on to stars like Liz Taylor, Audrey Hepburn, Natalie Wood. They were very much a kind of very different model of like femininity being proffered. But there obviously were, you know, they were contending with similar things. But I think the question of mature content and sexual explicitness and nudity were happening in Hollywood. And Hollywood was really trying to distinguish itself from these emergent films that were circulating and trying, you know, Hollywood is trying to characterize sexploitation films as really like, you know, these are these fly-by-night operators that are ruining it for us. We're trying to have a respectable business. But what sexploitation offered is that they were outside of the province of the code, and so that they didn't have to subscribe to the same premises as Hollywood films did. So there was this kind of area of contest and transformation going on in the 60s that really highlights the difference between Hollywood films and the more crass or more vulgar, the kind of the sense of the felt explicitness of what sexploitation films offered.
Right. And with its offerings, of course, would draw a new kind of audience that was going away from the classic mm-hmm. cinema. As you mentioned, it was kind of the revival of the neighborhood cinema. These adult-only cinemas mm-hmm. were kind of an open secret. So what were the target audiences mm-hmm. for sexploitation films? You know, was it yeah. men and women or primarily men?
These are films made by men, largely for men, but the audience does shift in the mid to late 60s as there's much more of a, you know, the culture is becoming more permissive. And also we have, you know, their sexuality is also very visible in foreign films and, you know, import films. And so, and obviously this is, you know, we have the counterculture and this obviously a movement towards some of the, you know, elements of what we associate with like the sexual revolution. So that I think a couple's audience becomes quite significant for sexploitation films, particularly in urban areas. And I think the films do then circulate by the late 60s. In interesting ways, but not without contest and not without some protest. It's a really interesting time period, too, to think about the changing nature of the film audience itself and the way that the film audience is also bracketing. And I do talk a lot about both the idea of the audience, but also the like actual audiences that saw the films and talked about and wrote about watching the films in the book.
Yeah, you just mentioned, you know, they're kind of like time capsules, these films, but mm-hmm. largely at the time, they're made with such a quick turnover, it was almost mm-hmm. a throwaway film. So I'm curious, did you have difficulties researching this and finding these films when they were considered one and done?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's a really important part of understanding the films. They were made on this very fast turnaround, both in terms of production and sometimes in terms of exhibition. Sometimes the films would get repackaged, and then you'd see them a few years later in a slightly different form, in a more, you know, with added footage, perhaps. So there are these strange ways the films are kind of anachronistic in a variety of ways where they kind of are like of their time and very contemporary, but then they also seem sometimes belated. But researching them was interesting because, I mean, these films don't exist in any single archive, you know, whereas a Hollywood film, you know, you can go to the Margaret Herrick Library or, you know, the American Film Institute and you can find films, you know, of a particular filmmaker or of a particular body of work in an archive. But these films actually were largely recovered by amateur historians and fans and collectors who collected the films and actually created independent for-profit businesses in selling them on video. One of the most significant companies was Something Weird Video. So when I first started this, I was watching these films on VHS, bootlegging them on VHS mm-hmm. from my local video store, and consuming them that way. And now they've kind of moved on to DVD, not without losses and licensing issues. So it's a very spotty and unruly archive. There is something important about preservation in thinking about these films because of their kind of cultish, almost like bad movie qualities. They often, you know, are not treated as seriously as other forms of cinema. And I think that has worked to their detriment. And it's it would be incredible to have an actual institutionally affiliated archive that held them. But it created challenges because, you know, there were no places to go and look at all the papers. Usually filmmakers didn't, you know, think their films had value. So a lot of times if filmmakers or producers would just get rid of films, get rid of their papers and all of that. Those trails had to be reconstructed. So I was very interested to think about what their impact was in a public sphere of film culture. And that was my approach and a way of dealing with some of those gaps and some of those difficulties of that, you know, the spottiness of that archive. But other people have done quite a lot of oral history as well and interviewing folks. And so that also is an important aspect with people are still, you know, there's a way that is very, very, very pronounced graying of the people and kind of, you know, a lot of people have passed away. And so that aspect of it is also quite important to keep that history alive.
Do you see the views of coming at this through a scholarly perspective or even a public one shift? Because, mm-hmm. you know, America is still rather Puritan in what mm-hmm. it thinks is acceptable either for historical preservation mm-hmm. or anything else. But do you see the tide turning as you were diving into this project?
Yeah, I think there is somewhat of a tide turning. I think it has to do with these kind of younger but commercial entities and companies that are and younger kind of amateur historians that are interested in it. But I do think that there does need to be a place that a more institutional recognition. And that was also the importance of doing this book in this way in terms of scale and approach. Certainly, I do think the tide is shifting to some degree, but I think in some ways public perception and a kind of perception of what is the obscene in some ways is predeterminative and overdetermining, and it in some ways becomes forbidding. So I think it's quite easy, especially in our highly hypermediated and accelerated moment, to write things off and to have a hot take and then to bracket things off, and our time feels much more pressurized. So I think to sit down with one of these films as opposed to a film by Cassavetes, or who was not, you know, it was like kind of in this geographically working in a geographically proximate world, and one can think about ways an independent film tradition is working alongside, and these are independent films. So I think that those are kind of challenges in making these films exciting or interesting to look into for a wider audience, or to kind of for them to be taken seriously.
What do you think its lasting impact was on the portrayal of women in film?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that in some ways there was a kind of continuity of what sexploitation films did in relationship to the way that obviously the important feminist critique of a critic like Laura Mulvey about the male gaze and about female spectacle is certainly what she wrote after these, you know, she wrote in 1975. And in some ways, in one way, one could say these films anatomize that argument. They really make that really quite visible, that here we have this way that the, you know, female sexuality becomes quite literally the form of spectacle that is really at the heart of cinema. On the other hand, I think the films are interesting in their ability to document kind of like the everyday habits and comportment and like the ways of being feminine of a kind of, you know, of a range of women that we wouldn't normally see in cinema. So I think there's something about the way that the films preserve that that is quite important, that is less about kind of an affirmative representation or a positive representation or a negative representation. I think it's interesting to think about, to take seriously, like the notion that like some, you know, like these women wanted to act in films, and they, many of them took their work, you know, seriously and were proud of it. Some were not. But I think that it's important to think about labor, women's labor and performance in film. And I think that that is something the films make us think about in interesting ways in relationship to sex. If we think only in terms of like positive or negative representations, then the films aren't necessarily legible or interesting. I think their legacy is, in a way, a lot about America. It's like, it's much very linked to kind of the fundamental anxiety and ambivalent relationship American culture has to female sexuality. And so that they make that quite clear. I don't think that's in any way been resolved
right.
In the contemporary moment. But I think in some ways that because they were so brash, they offered something very different, you know, in the sense that there's something about the force of the expression. Like here is the sudden, like female sexuality was like this detonating force. Like earlier you mentioned Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, a very kind of significant film by Russ Meyer. And there, like the women are these insane badasses who are, you know, and they in some ways become, you know, these feminist icons in cult circles. And like, then I think it's interesting to think about the nuances of the way in which women appear, kind of how, you know, how is it that we understand what a woman's body means in cinema? So in that respect, they're quite interesting.
Right. You mentioned they kind of exist in an interesting juxtaposition or contradictory nature, and how they can be viewed as a positive portrayal or pro-feminism or other things like that. But then also looking at today in juxtaposition, today's political climate, and also all of the sexual harassment scandals that have become quite public and have changed the dialogue of, you know, the value of women and still the issue of women's sexuality and other things like that. So how did you view your research and these films in today's post-Weinstein scandal and larger cultural significance?
Right. I mean, I think that it's been quite interesting to see. It's unraveling and unfolding as we speak, but it's really quite incredible to in the way that Harvey Weinstein and After has played out, and the kinds of the sense of consciousness that it has introduced in a very public sphere. Thinking about these films in that context, I think it reinforces the sense in which that they're like, I think for me that the films are not necessarily the cause, but they're the symptom of a larger infrastructure of inequality. At the same time, I think it makes the work of close reading and the work of historical research, the work of reading women's stories in these films even more pressing in a variety of ways, because I think there's a double thing that happens, that it's like at the same time that one says, like, well, the woman becomes an object and she's only an object, in some ways it's discounting that woman's labor and that woman as a person who acted and worked and had certain conditions of work. There is a way of approaching those questions historically that I think are very productive and can both work in the space of critique and to challenge the patriarchy at the same time as embracing forms of sexual expressivity that are outside the norm and outside of a kind of puritanical framework, right? I mean, certainly I would consider myself like a pro-sex feminist as a product of those debates in the 80s and 90s about pornography. And so I think it's quite important to look at these works closely and to take them seriously, regardless of what position you take on them. But to take them seriously means to actually watch them and to engage with them as meaningful texts.
Elena Gorfinkel is the author of Lewd Looks, American Sexploitation Cinema in the 1960s. She's a senior lecturer in film studies at King's College in London, England. She formerly taught film at UW-Milwaukee, and she is back in town to talk about her new book this evening at Boswell Book Company.
We will take another break now and then tour the Modernism exhibit that's currently on view at the Milwaukee Art Museum. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Walking through the current Modernism exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum is kind of like walking through an art history textbook, except a lot more fun. The works date from the early 1800s to around 1950 and include everyone from the famous, like Degas and Picasso, to lesser known but equally important artists.
I had a chance to walk through the exhibit recently with the museum's associate curator of prints and drawings, Brittany Salisbury. She started our tour in the center of the exhibition with the work she feels best represents the exhibit as a whole.
So this is a drawing by Edgar Degas, and Degas was part of a movement called Impressionism, which many people are familiar with. Most of the Impressionist artists were focused on representing life in contemporary Paris. Degas was more interested in working in his studio. So while most of the Impressionists were going out into the city and representing what they saw, he worked a little bit more privately. And so he did this series of works that depict bathers. And as you can see by looking around the gallery, this was something that interested him. It really preoccupied him, and it interested him for decades. And so the works in this gallery date from, you know, the 1870s to goes to 1906. What I really love about this work is that it shows how Degas was experimenting with materials at the time. He used pastel frequently, which is a sort of powdery chalk that sort of breaks apart as you run it across a sheet of paper. And he developed and frequently used an existing technique called fixing. And so what he would do is he would draw and put one layer of pastel down on the sheet, and then he would spray it with an adhesive so it would seal it to the paper. Then he could go back and do another layer over that and create these really unusual juxtapositions of color and types of line.
Without it getting all muddy.
Right, right. Right. And so it would sort of let it stick to the surface of the paper and allow him to build layers on top of one another.
I'm curious why you took me right here to the center. Why is this piece, and why are these bathers in the center of this exhibition?
Well, the reason I took you to this piece is because the show is so focused on works on paper. And one of the things that, by works on paper, I mean prints and drawings. And I think this work does a really great job of showing the way that prints and drawings were just as important to the artists who were inventing modern art as paintings or sculpture were. And so people, I think, often when they think about modern art, they think of big paintings by Picasso and Manet, but these sorts of things were actually, they also appeared in their exhibitions, and they saw them as, you know, just important. And I think this particular work just really shows how these artists were experimenting with the materials that were available to them.
So put Degas in the context of this whole exhibition. This is sort of the invention of modernism in France. And so what do we mean by modernism, and where does Degas fit?
So modernism is a tricky term even for art historians. We, you know, go back and forth on it. But generally in the context of this exhibition, we're looking at artists who were thinking about experimentation, who were taking the sort of standards and traditions of art and rethinking them, beginning around 1800. And so they had all, for the most part, been taught at the Academy of Fine Arts, and they all showed their work in the Paris Salon, which was a big public exhibition, and wanted to do something different. They didn't want to just accept what they were being taught. And so this begins around 1800, and in the context of this exhibition, goes through about 1950.
Okay, so 150 years, and so you can see the progression of what people were experimenting with. Why do you think France was such a nexus for this movement, rather than, say, Germany or Italy or even England?
Well, France, and specifically Paris, was where the Academy of Fine Arts was located, and also where the Paris Salon was located. This is, again, this big public exhibition. And so there was a real system there. Artists would go to train at the Academy, then they would stay and train in the, enter the studio of a professional painter or sculptor, and then after that they would start to submit their work to exhibitions. And so there was like a real built-in system there for...
So whether you were French or not.
Right, exactly. Right. So artists were coming from all around Europe to Paris at this time. And I think this just continues to develop over the course of the period covered by the exhibition. And so once artists start to work more experimentally, they have places like cafes and studios, galleries where they can show their work. But there are lots of places for them to gather, in addition to this older pre-existing system of the Academy, studios, and the Salon.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not an art historian, but I think, wasn't the first parts of Impressionism, which I think a lot of us who don't know a lot about art history might think of the first stirrings of that modernist trend of, like, we're breaking away from this more formalist way of painting, particularly. That wasn't really accepted at the time, was it? I mean, weren't there kind of, like, rejections, and they had to kind of create their own space to do it, or exhibit it, at
least? There were. There were. Most of these movements were, I mean, they were really pushing the boundaries of what art could be. And so I think, you know, today we look at Impressionism and you see it on, like, calendars and umbrellas and things like
it's
that.
It's normal.
It's everywhere. Yeah. And so it seems like, you know, the tamest thing imaginable. But at the time, it was completely revolutionary, and couldn't be shown at the Salon. The artists had to form their own group exhibitions and galleries and sort of build their own system of promoting their art.
So as you were putting things together, this is 150 years, this whole exhibition kind of ranges, and it's works on paper, so prints and drawings primarily, although there are a few sculptures in here that I see. How did you choose? There must have been thousands of possibilities of how you could focus the exhibition.
Right. Well, the exhibition actually came to us from the Ashmolean Museum, which is the art museum at Oxford University in England. And they had put the show together initially. The works themselves came from a private collection. And so our version of the show is an expanded version of the Ashmoleans. They had 137, we have 150, which I guess 150 years, 150 works of art.
Perfect.
But I worked to supplementing their version of the show. I selected some additional 19th century drawings, and there are a few 20th century paintings in the later galleries, and also the small sculptures that you noticed are additions to are specific to our version.
And that
of
was
the show.
In our collection here?
No, these are all from the private collection.
Okay, so you went there to say, okay, we're going to pull this and this and this to add.
Right, right.
So again, how did you choose? You know, even though you didn't come up with the entire exhibition yourself, you did supplement it.
In choosing the 19th century, course, I'm a specialist in 19th century European works on paper, and so it was very fun for me to be able to choose some additional works. There were some artists who I was excited to be able to add works by or supplement, you know, new names to, you know, be able to add to the narrative of the history of modern art, and so made the choices that way.
All right, so we came to somebody who, anyone who knows, you know, French art in the 1800s would know Degas. Mm-hmm. Take me to someone that we might not know.
Sure. Okay. Go right around the corner.
Okay.
So these are two drawings by Armand Guillaumin, who was a French artist working in the late 19th, early 20th century. And he was working with the Impressionists, so he was focusing on life in contemporary France. But his work is usually distinguished by his interest in sort of the industrialization that he saw going on at the time. And so in the drawing on the right, I feel like you get a really good sense of that. He's showing this distinctly contemporary landscape, and the reason that we can tell it's contemporary is by these factories and barges and boats throughout the drawing. And his name is not so well known today, but he actually participated in almost all of the Impressionist group exhibitions, and he was seen as very central to their group at the time that they were working. And the drawing on the right was actually owned during the 19th century by the American artist Mary Cassatt, so it came from her collection and was probably a gift from Guillaumin to Cassatt to sort of commemorate their friendship.
That's pretty cool when you think both of them touched that.
Yeah.
Now, looking at the one on the left, you know, I would look at it not knowing anything about this painter, this artist. I would say that doesn't strike me as what I think of as typical Impressionism. It's a little more realistic.
And that's a very good point. And this one, so the one that you're looking at is actually significantly later than the one on the right.
Okay.
And so it was nice to in the exhibition to be able to do this in several places throughout the show, to be able to show how specific artists' work progressed as they moved forward, you know, from the 19th into the 20th century. And in the later drawing, Guillaumin starts to be influenced more by developments that are going on at the time, like the emergence of a movement called Fauvism, which was focused on color and brush strokes, and this very non-naturalistic color that doesn't really have anything to do with reality, but is more response to, on the artist's part, to what he's seeing and the experience of being outside in nature, representing the scene.
So of all of the works in here, do you have one that you come back to over and over and over again just to kind of stand in front of and say, wow?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's go into the 20th century.
Okay. We're walking by Cézanne.
passing by
Cézanne.
So this is one of my favorites, and one that always just sort of blows me away. It is by the French artist Fernand Léger. And he was working just after Picasso and Braque invent cubism in the early 20th century. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating about him is that he took cubism and recognized it as this, you know, amazing development that was happening in art making. But he wanted to make his own spin on it. And his specific concern was that he didn't think it was accessible enough to a wide public. He thought it was too elite, and that, you know, it didn't have, there just wasn't enough for ordinary people to latch on to. And so he experimented with it and tried to come up with his own, you know, take that would be more accessible. And so in this work, you know, the evidence of cubism that we see is the geometric, the brightly colored geometric shapes in the background.
The hands.
Yeah.
Yep.
But then he's also combined it with this really legible image of a mother and a child, which is based on, you know, traditional iconography of the Virgin and Child. And so it's something that people, you know, if they thought about paintings that they had seen in a museum or a church, this might be something that
they
could latch
it.
Onto.
Yeah,
right.
They'd recognize it.
Right.
But yeah, as you say, it's a modern take of it and could be anywhere.
Right.
You know.
But I think that the idea of, you know, an artist recognizing in, you know, like 1949 that he wants to be an avant-garde artist and he wants to experiment, but he also wants to engage with a wider public and to, you know, do something for people when they're looking at his work. I think that's really compelling.
It really is, and it's beautiful. It's one I've never seen this, and I love the color blocks. And it's gouache, yeah.
Yeah, and just like in the hair of the figures, they have this really stark, you know, black hair, and he's sort of scraped out the pigment in different spots, you know, in the hair to make it to show the area where, you know, it's shining.
Highlights.
So, yeah, exactly.
He's giving them highlights.
Right.
That's great. So he was born sort of in the middle of the Impressionists,
yes,
and then,
yes,
you know, went until the middle of the 1950s.
Yes. Yeah. And every work in this gallery is by him, and it's one of several galleries in the exhibition that we were able to devote to single artists. So we have this gallery of Léger works, we have 11 works by Picasso and Degas.
To wrap up, Brittany, take me to one more piece.
One more piece. Let's go. So this is a drawing by another French artist, Robert Delaunay, and it's one of two, along with the work next to it, it is one of two designs for the 1937 International Exhibition of Art and Technology in Modern Life in Paris, which was part of the Universal Exhibition that year. What I think is great about this is that that year there were a group of unemployed artists were commissioned to create these murals for the exhibition, and so Delaunay was one of several artists that were commissioned to make these murals about aviation. And, you know, at the time he was commissioned, he was working in this entirely abstract way. He's focusing on very spare geometric shapes, concentric circles, and the contrast between primary colors. And so, you know, whoever commissioned him knew that he was going to make something really out there. And so this is it seems entirely abstract, but it's actually, he's using, you know, the style of avant-garde art at the time to represent the motion of a propeller. And so you can see this in the way that he's broken up the different circles and used these horizontal lines to evoke movement.
And it's really gorgeous,
yeah,
on top of it. I mean, it's just, you just sort of stand on it, and it takes you a minute to quite, I try not to look at the text, you know, when I don't know something, I try to just kind of get an impression first and then see if I'm even close.
Yeah.
And you can see that movement, and you can see, but it is initially like, oh, there's circles and colors, and you're not quite sure what's going on,
right,
and then it starts to make sense.
Right. I love to think about people in 1937 encountering this in a pavilion about planes. You know?
Right, because planes
the
weren't
last
that
thing you would expect
common.
To see.
Yeah,
right.
And they weren't that common at that point.
Right,
even, you
right.
know, not everyone was flying everywhere, and
yeah,
and it's beautifully, I love the blue lines.
Yeah,
yeah, I love that
so
sense of movement. I was thinking water too.
Yeah,
that it was like flying over water.
Yeah, no, I think it could just as easily be that. I think he wanted it to be deliberately vague and
yeah,
open to the viewer's interpretation.
So what do you hope that people take away from the entire exhibition? We've only talked about four works, and there's
right,
many, many, as you said, 150
right,
to take in. And, you know, what do you hope people take away from it?
Well, I hope that people come out of it knowing, well, having a little bit better understanding what modern art is. But I also hope people come out of it understanding a little bit more about prints and drawings and why artists chose, some of the reasons that artists chose to use those techniques rather than paintings, and the fact that, you know, using, you know, techniques like pastel or lithography or crayon, it was often a very specific and strategic choice on the part of these artists, and, you know, artists could do things in these techniques that they couldn't necessarily do in the paintings that they exhibited in public places. And so I hope that, you know, as a curator of prints and drawings, I hope that I have some converts to prints and drawings from visitors to the exhibition.
And not think of it as a less than medium.
Right,
yeah,
right, right. It's an entirely different medium and one that artists saw as, you know, just as important to their practices.
Well, thank you so much for
thank
taking
you for
time
having
today.
Me. Yes, it's been a pleasure.
Brittany Salisbury is the Associate Curator of Prints and Drawings at the Milwaukee Art Museum. She's responsible for bringing the exhibition Degas to Picasso, Creating Modernism in France, to Milwaukee from Oxford. The exhibit is open until late January, and you can find more at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break, and then Radio Chipstone considers the aluminum Christmas tree in its natural environment. That's when Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Should you find yourself strolling along the Capitol Square in Madison over the next few weeks, you might notice something shiny on North Carroll Street. It's not spaceships catching your eye, though. It is a series of aluminum Christmas trees lighting up the night.
The trees were produced 40 to 50 years ago by the Aluminum Specialty Company in Manitowoc. Thousands of the company's Evergleam trees eventually found their way into American homes. Even long since the company stopped producing them, websites like Pinterest, eBay, and Etsy have allowed enthusiasts to collect and share their love by posting photos of the silver, blue, pink, and green faux trees.
But something linked to those trees has become nearly impossible to find. Joe Kapler is the curator of cultural history for the Wisconsin Historical Society. He says it's difficult to find authentic photos of the trees in their 1960s and 70s living rooms.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Kapler and contributor Jennifer Fields encourage you to take some time to appreciate your surroundings, because in a world of staged photos and posed selfies, they say evidence of the everyday American living room is disappearing.
We're here in the first floor of the Wisconsin Historical Society Museum on Wisconsin's Capitol Square, and we're looking at the period vintage living room setting that we've created. And we sought out these pieces. These are vintage 1960s sofa, end table, lamp, chair, even the wonderful clock, and curtains. Period curtains, and so these are from our usage collection, our education collection, and we invite people to plunk down, take their photo. It's extremely popular, not just for selfies, but Christmas card photos, group office groups come over to take their Christmas card or their holiday card photo here. It's been extremely popular.
So wait a minute, wait, hold it, time out. When we think of museums, we think of places where things are precious, and certainly these are precious. That desire for people to come in and take photos and place themselves in this particular time period, to me, it's a bit fascinating. And I thought when I walked in here, I purposely didn't step on the rug. I didn't step on anything.
I did.
I put all my things in my backpack that's very tight to my back. It didn't dawn on me that this was actually opened up for people to re-experience this period in their life, whether or not they actually experienced it the first time.
Having immersive environments, to use that terminology we do in the museum field, is certainly a greater need. Our 21st century audiences kind of expect that. And so we do have the beautiful trees that are meant to be preserved permanently. And they are behind protective glass and cases and ropes and things. But then we also are offering this immersive environment to plunk down and take your photo. And yes, there is a fake... It's an old-fashioned. It's not a Manhattan. It's an old-fashioned. Of course, that's Wisconsin, right? That you can kind of have the texture and the feel of what it might have been like in a 1960s living room, and then the pose with the tree. And we're also standing next to a hands-on tree, one that we acquired for people to touch and feel. What are those branches? What is aluminum foil chaff? What does it feel like? What is it to take one out of the trunk and back in? And we have that available for people as well. So if you want to come and just observe, some of these are amazingly spectacular and bright trees for being 60 some years old. And but you can also plunk down, and we have a case there full of props and hats and, you know, again, period props for, I don't know, maybe visitors 30 and younger. They'll intuitively go there and plunk down and immediately take photos and get it. Maybe for visitors, say, 30 and older, they kind of look around. Can I step on this linoleum? Can I step on this rug? Right. And it's part of kind of our conditioning.
And I got to tell you, Joe, part of me not wanting to step on it, because in my head, this takes me to that particular time in my life. I'm looking for the closet where the vacuum cleaner is, because that's a white rug. And it's going to need to be vacuumed, and that was one of my jobs. Individually, any one of those pieces in a thrift store or anywhere else is not going to evoke that time period. You put them all together, you put that aluminum tree in the corner, and you shine that
color wheel.
Color wheel, I want to call it the rainbow wheel. You sign that color wheel on it, and it suddenly is transformative.
And it's the composition of the scene. And you are correct. All those pieces came from vintage or secondhand stores, antique malls. And, you know, we spent a little time on the side hunting and gathering and to compose this, what I think is very representative and fairly authentic and accurate. You're not going to get really period carpeting because that gets consumed. But even the curtains in the back there. So these things, these would have been in people's living rooms in the 60s, maybe in the 70s and the 80s. They got moved down to the basement family rec room, or some, you know, ended up maybe in grandma's house. And then 30 years later, they get into an estate sale or something like that, and they end up in a vintage store. Many people approach history that way as well. You and I are material culture people. We study this. We actually probably spent more time looking at definitions and studying photographs than we did going kicking around antique stores. But for many people, it's eBay or it's antique stores or the secondhand, the thrift stores, the resale shops, all of that. That's how they experience history. Maybe a little more tactile. So we want to be able to engage those learners as well.
And I think that's what I love about the Historical Society is that you put it in my hands. You allow me to participate. It helps me see the things in my home and the things from my lifetime and many other people in who use the Historical Museum or come to the Historical Museum. It helps us see our world through a different lens. And it sort of helps you put your life into context in the sense of being part of something bigger than just you. And it creates this sort of community in this context of these trees or these objects.
You know, we're humanities-based. We're essentially often subject-driven, not necessarily artist-driven when we work with arts and folk art and things like that. In this case, the subject for us is the maker. It's a Loom Specialty Company out of Manitowoc, Wisconsin. If this was Loom Specialty Company out of Greenville, Indiana, this exhibition isn't happening here. And so we're telling an innovation story, a business story, a Wisconsin industry story. We can get to there with shiny trees. If you start the lecture, you know, Wisconsin is home to numerous varied industries and not just agricultural and beer and brewing. You know, you may lose a lot of your people. This isn't history class. You're not supposed to sit here for the next 55 minutes until the bell rings. We need to meet people kind of where they're at, and so that is absolutely what we do. And the living room part is, of course, it's fun and of course it's popular, but there's another level to it, and that is providing an authentic context. So I also go to eBay and to Pinterest and social media to look at, because now everyone takes their parents' photos and they scan them and they post them online. And what I've been looking for are pictures of these in context. A lot of pictures that are out there now are done more recently and they're composed, and it's very much in a mid-century modern context and environment. I want to see a period image that shows that. Can't find them. Looked at many, many, many scenes. We can't go back into millions of people's living rooms in the 1960s. I want those candid Christmas photos, the kids in front, you know, so that it's not like it's composed or altered. That's what we do, right? We want to travel back in time.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with Joe Kapler, curator of cultural history for the Wisconsin Historical Society. That is Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.